I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. Introducing Andy Worthington. He's the author of the book, The Guantanamo Files. He writes for us at antiwar.com as well as for Counterpunch, the Future Freedom Foundation. His own website is andyworthington.co.uk. Welcome back to the show, Andy.
Yeah, and good to be here.
How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm all right, actually. I'm not bad.
That's good. Hey, listen, before we get into all the subject matter here, tell me about this movie you're making and how far along it's gotten.
Well, it's very close to completion, actually.
Yeah?
We're just having some screenings for people to see how they think about it, which hopefully, you know, we've had some screenings already. It's going well. And then hopefully get it out to people in broadcasting, in particularly the Arabic media, actually. We'd really like it to be shown in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
It basically features a number of released prisoners and lawyers and me. Just really running through the story of what Guantanamo is about, and you know, less to do with coming from a kind of torture point of view, more to do with how that developed as a result of trying to get information out of people who shouldn't have been there in the first place. So there's quite a bit about the intelligence failures that led to Guantanamo not being full of the worst of the worst, but of, you know, innocent men and Taliban foot soldiers who knew nothing about any terrorist plot.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the name of the movie going to be? Do you know for sure?
I think it's going to be called Outside the Law or Beyond the Law, The Story of Guantanamo,
mm-hmm.
one or the other. Still tossing the coin to decide which of those. Really.
Mm. I like Outside, because Beyond... I think that the rule of men was first, the rule of law came second. So it's really been a devolution here, not some sort of, you know, beyond the law thing. It's really less than the law. Sort of.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you, actually. I was just thinking about that yesterday, actually, that beyond almost makes it sound like you could be justified in creating somewhere beyond
right.
where we're at.
Right. We're beyond the law here, but we got to torture this guy or else the nuclear bomb will go off in L.A. Don't you watch Fox?
Yeah. No.
Yeah, I know. I don't either. I saw that show like one time and then that's about it.
So did I. When it started, I watched it. I thought, well, this is horrible. What's going on? And the only time that I ever see Fox the rest of the time is in clips on The Daily Show.
Yeah. Well, there's The Simpsons and the Sunday night cartoons, but that's something else entirely. All right. Okay, so let's get into some of the subject matter going on in the last week. There's all kinds of stuff to talk about. I want to talk about the outside the law legal issues, you know, in the large sense. But if possible, I'd like to start with some significant details. And I wonder if you can catch up our listeners on the story of Binyam Mohamed and what's happened to him and recent developments in his case, Andy.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, Binyam finally returned to the UK 2 weeks ago. He was kind of hustled to the top of the list of the Obama administration's review of the prisoners, which is interesting because that was specifically because I think on both sides of the Atlantic, both in Britain and in the States, it was more sensible for everybody to get Binyam out of Guantanamo to try and hush up all talk of complicity in his torture by the British and his actual torture by the Americans. So, you know, he's the first person to be released by the Obama administration. And, you know, clearly there are... my way of rather cynically looking at it is that the fast track out of Guantanamo now is to have been through the most horrendous extraordinary rendition and torture. You know, and a lot of the guys who are sitting there who haven't had it quite so bad... you know, are not at the top of the list to be sent home.
Hmm.
Binyam did a major interview, which was published in Britain's Daily Mail newspaper yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Slightly odd in a way. That's quite a conservative newspaper, but the journalist who did the interview, David Rose, used to work for the left-wing papers and has kind of got this niche where he get to do the interviews with the released prisoners.
He's an interesting guy, that David Rose. He did such great work on the Sybil Edmonds case, but if you rewind a few years before that, he really helped lie us into war in Iraq.
Right. It's I think he may have come to regret that, you know, in the years since. But of course, you know, from my point of view, I don't really understand how anybody could not have seen what was going on in 2002. But
yeah,
there you go. That's another matter.
Right. Anyway,
but, you know, Binyam has spoken. He's done what he says will be the only interview, and is now going to, you know, spend some time trying to get his head back together, understandably. But he specifically spoke in much more detail about this kind of cover-up that's been going on here in the UK, of how much the British colluded in his interrogations, and specifically in providing information to his interrogators when he was in Morocco. So just to recap briefly, you know, he was captured in Pakistan, came to the attention of US agents. They then bizarrely concluded that he was tied in with major Al-Qaeda figures, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, people like this, that he was involved in a dirty bomb plot, the one that later Jose Padilla got roped into being involved in as well.
Mm-hmm.
And sent Binyam Mohammed to Morocco, where he was tortured for 18 months until he made up the kind of confessions that they wanted. Now, it's always been known that, but by his lawyers, that the British had fed questions to his Moroccan torturers via the Americans. And, you know, they shouldn't have been doing that because they didn't know where he was. They didn't know in what conditions he was being held. So a lot more of that has come out in this interview. And there are, I'm glad to say, quite a lot of people jumping up and down at the moment in Britain asking for the British government not to keep making blanket statements that it doesn't approve of torture, but to actually hold some kind of proper inquiry as mm-hmm. to what's been going on.
Well, and according to that Daily Mail article, I guess basically the way they had it constructed in there was that they knew, the British knew, that he was not being held at any American military base, and yet they knew he was being held by the CIA. So, therefore, they must have known that he was at some secret CIA ghost prison, whether in Morocco or somewhere else, that they must have known that he was outside the law, probably was being held by a torture state.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, but the thing is that, you know, there's been a lot coming out recently about Britain's involvement in this, that, that you know, the British government seems to routinely have been feeding information to interrogators in Pakistan, for example, who are pretty notorious for using torture, in the case of British nationals who have been captured out there. You know, and I understand that they think that there's a terror threat. But the problem, as ever, and it's exactly the same problem that we've always had while discussing the Bush administration, is that it doesn't matter that you fear that there's a terror threat. Torturing people is wrong and counterproductive. But the British seem to be up to their necks in it. I mean, I've just heard today there's a UN report coming out criticizing countries for their complicity in torture. You know, Britain's on the list and Canada's on the list, along with some of the former Yugoslavian countries, and then countries like Indonesia and Pakistan. So Britain and Canada are up there with Indonesia and Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Glenn Greenwald points out on his blog today that the reaction to these revelations about what happened to Binyam Mohammed and the British government's involvement in it across the board, from the Conservative Party and from parts of the Labour Party and whatever there in England, they're calling for criminal investigations, period. Hey, torture's against the law.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Glenn makes the point that nobody is arguing that, hey, there's a financial crisis, or, hey, we need to look forward, not backward, or, no, this is what happens in a country where there's a rule of law. Even if they break it, eventually there's got to be some comeuppance and some accountability for these people.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, it's funny because more and more is coming out, and the position that we're ending up in is exactly the same position that's been happening in the States for years, which is, you know, that the Bush administration tried to claim that the necessity was such that they had to break the law. But, you know, the truth is, no. You know, we've spent such a long time getting to a position where we avoid the use of torture and where we regard it as repugnant and useless, that to start backsliding is tragic. And unnecessary. You know, again, we've talked before, Scott, about the, you know, the ways of working within the law to interrogate people, to get useful information out of them. I bang on about it incessantly because it is the 24 mentality to believe that, you know, these are such tough guys that the only way you can get anything out of them is to beat them senseless.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know? And it's kind of just the American view that morality can be suspended in special circumstances. Name it. You know what I mean? Just come up with a special circumstance and all of a sudden the rules don't apply anymore. And Americans can be convinced of that, apparently, especially if they have a TV show that hammers at home every week, you know?
Well, exactly, you know, and you know, I mean, to some extent, you know, that same kind of coarsening of the human rights mentality has happened in Britain as well. There are plenty of people here happy to say that they believe that the threat is such that, you know, that any kind of activity involving torture is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the tragic thing here is that people have forgotten that exactly the same thing happened with the Irish in the 1970s and the 1980s, and all it did was create martyrs. All it did was create a mass movement where there hadn't been one. I mean, it fails on every level. And I'm astonished that people, you know, don't remember that who are in the government here, because they were old enough to have lived through it.
Well, and they eventually applied those lessons and decided that, you know what, we've got to make some concessions and compromise to end the violence here, and it actually worked.
Yeah. Well, that's always the way, isn't it? You know, these people really don't like sitting around a table, but, you know, I'd be constantly pushing them. You know, will you talk, please? Just talk.
Right. Now, you know, and here's something that I actually thought of you as soon as I read this was Benjamin Mohammed's statement that his lowest point, despite having his genitals mutilated, despite being hung from his wrists like Jesus, you know, his lowest point was when they came in with a bunch of British documents in their hand, and he knew then that Britain was conspiring in this torture against him and was not making any effort to protect his rights. That was his lowest ebb, they said in the article there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's spoken about that. I mean, that kind of came out when he was first able to tell his story, when a lawyer was first allowed to visit him in 2005. And in the summer of 2005, you know, it's been known for that long that, you know, that that's what he said. And clearly it would be, because, I mean, his only lifeline, I suspect, when he was, you know, in Morocco being tortured, knew that the CIA was directly behind everything that was happening. His only lifeline must have been to think, you know, maybe the British are going to come and ride in like the cavalry at some point, because they told him in Pakistan before he was sent to Morocco that they'd checked him out in Britain, and they knew that he was a nobody, they called him. You know, he was a janitor at an Islamic center. He didn't have a record of any involvement with anything in Britain. You know, he was clean. So, you know, I can imagine what he went through. I can imagine how that must have felt like the ultimate betrayal.
All right, now you have a new one at the Future Freedom Foundation about how America's still a dictatorship. Doesn't matter. I guess we pin the tail on the emperor every 8 or 4 years or so. But you're saying that as far as the law is concerned, there remains a major loophole for Barack Obama to treat me, an American citizen, natural-born American citizen, just the way they've treated Benjamin Mohammed, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. It's kind of worrying, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I had to go with the real shock horror headline because, you know, it's as important as that, really, is that if you leave a legal opinion in place, and there is one which says that it's okay, then it does allow the administration to use it if they want to do. And it's not that I think that they will. I'm just slightly perturbed at how much they're fudging on certain issues at the moment and leaving certain avenues open when they really, really need categorically to say, no, we're not going to do this. And it's the problem that I think a lot of us have had for a number of years is, you know, that even with the best intention, politicians inherit whatever they inherit from the people who've been before. And are not necessarily going to give up all those kind of powers. And to me, we need some kind of arbiter who can just walk in there and say, no, look, you have to understand that we have to get rid of all of these powers that were established by the Bush administration. We have to go back to where we were before. You know, it's not being soft, it's not being stupid. It's being a country founded on the rule of law, and that's what we should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what Robert Higgs calls the ratchet effect, when there's an expansion of government power. Some of it might be repealed, but never back to the way it was before.
Yeah, I know, and it's distressing, isn't it? And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to, you know, I'd obviously encourage everybody to go and read that article that is attached to the sensationalist-sounding headline. But, you know, what this is about, just for a bit of context for the listeners, is that Ali al-Mari, who has been held as an enemy combatant on the U.S. mainland for nearly 6 years.
Who was arrested in Peoria, Illinois, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, being from the U.K. there, Andy, but Peoria, Illinois is actually sort of shorthand for any town in America.
Right.
Peoria is, how's this going to play in Peoria? That's the place, that's Middletown. That's where every American is from, kind of a
sure.
thing. And now
sure.
this, that's where this man was arrested, literally.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I'm glad that the administration has decided that he can no longer be held as an enemy combatant, and they're going to give him a federal court trial. The problem in the article that you're talking about is that they overturned, the Supreme Court was supposed to be reviewing his case. Now, because he's been moved into the federal court system, the Supreme Court doesn't have to look at whether the president of the United States, any president, is entitled to hold an American, whether a citizen or a resident, as an enemy combatant without charge or trial. Now, they overturned this horrible decision that was made by the Fourth Circuit Appeals Court last summer when they said, yes, the president can do that if that's what he wants to do, and said that in the case of al-Mari. But what nobody's addressed is that three judges in the same Fourth Circuit Appeals Court decided in 2005 that the same thing applied to Jose Padilla. Now, the man who was accused of being involved in the dirty bomb plot, the one that Binyam Muhammad got caught up in, who was eventually moved out of the brig where he'd been held and was got a 17-year sentence for providing material support for terrorism. And that ruling still stands, because when the Supreme Court got close to examining Padilla's case, the Bush administration moved him out of the brig, out of solitary confinement there as an enemy combatant, and moved him into the federal court system. So it's that ruling that still stands, and somebody needs to say, well, you know, this is not the kind of thing we should have on the books as existing at all. Mm-hmm. And I would like to, you know, to see people make a fuss about it, really. I would like it to be an issue, because I think it very much is at the heart of what the Bush administration tried to do with the war on terror. And it really is, you know, it's pre-habeas. It's putting America in a position where, you know, where the rest of the world was in the 13th century. And, you know, and it's particularly critical in American history because, you know, the founders of your nation established things exactly to prevent somebody from pretending to be a king who could act in any way that he felt fit.
So I just want to make sure I got this straight. So the Bush administration exercised virtually the exact same pretended power against Padilla and al-Mari. Padilla was an American citizen, al-Mari was not, but they were both arrested by civilian police on American soil, turned over to the domestic court system, and then were declared enemy combatants and turned over to the military. Now,
yeah.
When Padilla's case was about to get to the Supreme Court, they ducked it the first time. When it was about to go the second time, the Bush administration, as you say, basically turned around and indicted Padilla and held a trial in Miami in order to basically take away his standing to sue, in order to argue to the Supreme Court that this guy no longer has standing to challenge the power that we're wielding. And that worked. And now it looks like the Obama administration has done the same thing with the al-Mari case, indicting him rather than letting it go to the Supreme Court. But then the wrinkle here is that there are these lower court rulings. And in the case of al-Mari, the Supreme Court, even though they decided that he doesn't have standing to sue any longer, they went ahead and vacated a lower court ruling. But in the case of Padilla, that lower court ruling is still there and therefore is, you know, basically the law of the land at this point until the Supreme Court strikes that down. Is that right?
Yeah, that's basically it.
Okay, now...
I mean, I think it's very important to understand that, you know, the reasons that Padilla was moved out of isolation and the reasons that Almari is about to be moved out of the brig, if he's still there, are very different. I mean, the Bush administration did it solely because the Supreme Court was breathing down its neck. The Obama administration has correctly done it on the basis that it doesn't approve of holding somebody as an enemy combatant without charge or trial.
They've stated that explicitly in the paperwork or what?
No, I mean, that's why, you know, I mean, when Obama issued those orders in the first few days ordering Guantanamo to be shut, that was when he issued the presidential order saying, look, we need to address very swiftly this question of this guy Almari, who we've been holding as an enemy combatant, because this really doesn't look right.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, I don't think that I'm being lied to by the government in thinking that I'm sure they addressed this because they thought this isn't really what we should be doing. But what's worrying is that they've kept the door open. That's all it is. And, I mean, that might be inadvertent. They might not particularly have studied the fact that it still exists. But my feeling is that they're hedging their bets on quite a lot of things at the moment.
Well, but help me understand, though, because George Bush was doing this. He did this to these two men based on the theory that under the authorization to use military force passed after September 11th, that he's the king of the world and can do anything and no law can bind his authority. But then the Supreme Court has since ruled on that question and said that's not true. Only Congress can give him unlimited authority over all life on Earth. And then Congress did that. They passed the Military Commissions Act, which explicitly gave the president the power to declare people enemy combatants, even Americans, etc. So this court ruling that you're talking about is one left over from 2005. Does the Military Commissions Act not change the equation on how that argument plays out then?
Well, I'm not sure about that, actually. I need to look into it, because my understanding is that the arguments that have been made by Almari's lawyers are that although the judges were wrong, basically, in Padilla's case and in Almari's case when they said the president had the right. And it goes back much, much further than that. It goes back to the president basing his self-declared right on the authorization for use of military force. So, you know, the open-ended declaration of war on terrorism document that was passed by Congress a week after the 9/11 attacks. But the Patriot Act, which came 5 weeks later, explicitly said, no, you're not allowed to round up Americans and hold them as enemy combatants. You know, the Patriot Act is the law. And that's what the legal arguments have been based on for all these years. So I'm presuming that that counts. But, you know, I need to go away and look at the fine print of the Military Commissions Act again.
Yeah, well, it's very poorly written, as most of the Bush administration's laws. I think you can probably read a lot into it. But, of course, the Supreme Court already ruled in the, I never say it right, it looks like Bomadine to me, but that's not how you say it. But they ruled in that case that the way that the Military Commissions Act removed the writ of habeas corpus was not allowed to stand, basically.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah,
actually, sure. I'm trying to remember now why it was that they ruled that, because it was an act of Congress suspending the writ of habeas corpus, and Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution says that Congress can do that.
Oh, no, they very importantly ruled that Congress had acted unconstitutionally.
Oh, because there was no rebellion or invasion.
Yeah, when it had, you know, passed those parts of the legislation, so the Military Commissions Act and the Detainee Treatment Act, those parts relating to the habeas rights of prisoners, yeah, they said our politicians have just behaved unconstitutionally, which I thought was great.
Yeah, it really is something to try to take note of whenever the actual language of the Constitution is applied to stop government from doing something. Because that actually, I mean, honestly, like, that's pretty explicit language, pretty detailed language, the kind of language that's ignored. You know, like, if it says in the Constitution anywhere that anyone can suspend habeas corpus, a lot of times they'd like to think, well, if the Congress can do it, the President can do it. That's what Abraham Lincoln did, that kind of thing. And of course, if it says, okay, Congress can do it, but only in cases of rebellion or invasion, and a court is being so specific as to say terrorists coming into the country and blowing up some buildings or hijacking some planes does not count as a rebellion or an invasion, and so therefore this power is being applied too broadly, that really is something remarkable for that to happen. I would not have bet on it.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I think the fundamental thing is that although, you know, although we must always recall that the Supreme Court is very divided in terms of, you know, which different people make it up, you know, on the rulings where the majority has made these important opinions, what they were really doing was saying, look, we gave these guys habeas corpus rights in 2004. In 2004, how dare you mess around with us for 4 years unconstitutionally so that we have to come back 4 years later and tell you what we told you 4 years ago? You know, Cuba is not a black hole, and these guys have rights. That's so, what it was, really.
So really, that was the Bomadine decision was reinforcing the Hamdan decision.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Well, but didn't the Hamdan decision say, get Congress to pass a law and then you can do it? And then that's what they did.
There were always judges who were suggesting that that was the case. But, yeah, I mean, that is what they did. I mean,
it was just still too broad.
Congress went away and passed bad laws.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, you know, I've always been very nervous about the Supreme Court ruling on any of these things, because if they rule wrong, that's it. You know, they're the self-appointed deciders about what the Constitution says, and they're usually wrong. So I've been really happy to see the way they've ruled so far on a lot of these. All right, so let me change the subject here to the definitive list. You are the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. And now you have come out. It's available at andyworthington.co.uk, a four-part list, the total list of the detainees at Guantanamo. Can you just tell us some things we don't know about who these people are and what's important about their stories here?
Well, fundamentally, I suppose it's what I've been writing about for the last 3 years is attempting to establish who these guys were and why it might be that not all of them were the worst of the worst. And clearly, I think, you know, we've come a long way in the last few years that two-thirds of the guys have been released. We've got a change of administration. You know, there are still 240 people in there, and I would say that, you know, that three quarters of those could leave tomorrow and nobody would have any problems.
How many were there total? 774? Was that the grand total?
Well, there were five who were shipped in after I wrote my book, actually. So 779 in total.
And you say there's how many left? 200 and what?
241 there.
Wow. So is it fair to say that the government has basically admitted that all those other people were innocent?
Nope. They never claimed anybody was innocent. They just claimed that they didn't think that they were dangerous anymore, and so they could let them go. Seriously, I mean, you know, everybody who's walking around the world who was freed from Guantanamo effectively has a stamp on their head that says enemy combatant for the rest of their life. And somewhere down the line, you know, that really needs to be sorted out in the case of the guys in Britain, for example. I know that some of them have got passports, some of them haven't. You know, wait a minute, these guys were never charged with anything. And yet, you know, some of them have come back with an arrangement where they're not allowed to leave Britain again. Because, why? Because they're still an enemy combatant. I mean, it's crazy, you know.
Well, and there's no legal process anywhere for them to get that label removed.
Well, not really, no, because, I mean, that's the novelty of it, isn't it? That's the horrendous novelty of what the Bush administration came up with. You know, creating a new brand of person. An illegal enemy combatant. I mean, it's a crazy one. But, you know, to tell the listeners a bit about the list, it's really, it is the definitive list of everybody who's been held there, you know, updated. And particularly, it provides links. There are, I think, about 400 links to stories that I've been writing and extra stories in extra chapters that I've been writing over the last few years. And references to where the rest of the stories can be found in the book, which hopefully, you know, will help people with research in an attempt, you know, A, historically to understand what Guantanamo was about and who was held there and why over 90% of them should never have been held at all. And also, you know, hopefully for people to have a look at who's still there, you know, to have a look at some of those stories of the guys who are still held. Because, as I say, you know, over the years, the intelligence services have pretty firmly established that they reckon that the number of people with any meaningful connection to terrorist activities in any way is somewhere between 35 and 50 of the total number of 779 who've been held. So, you know, this used to be almost an academic exercise, Scott, because when the Bush administration was in, we had no idea why they were letting people go. They certainly weren't trying to conduct an official review. And for the first time in Guantanamo's seven-year history, we now have, you know, this interagency review that's being conducted by an administration that has declared that it wants to close the place. So they need to be, you know, they need to be looking very carefully at what evidence they regard as reliable. And part of the whole struggle over the years has been that the administration has piled up allegations against prisoners, but they're not based on anything that they knew when they captured them. They're based on what they found out afterwards, either by interrogating them or by interrogating other prisoners. And as we all know from the history of Guantanamo, people weren't often interviewed under the kind of circumstances that were conducive to them telling the truth.
Yeah, and that's, really that's a very nice way to say it.
Well, my analogy really would be, you know, if you were walking down the street in your town or city and the police arrested you and you said, what are you arresting me for? And they refused to tell you anything. They didn't have anything on you when they arrested you. And then they bang you up and then they just spend years building up a case against you. That's the story of Guantanamo, really.
Yeah, well, and we know from reports even way back when that from the time of the Afghan war that, yeah, there's a bunch of crazy warlords just gathering people up and selling them to the Americans. And, of course, the way the whole chain of command thing was basically a joke so that the guys on the ground, the Americans on the ground, you know, who are buying these people, they're just putting them on the plane. Now there's somebody else's problem. Then they land at Guantanamo Bay and the soldiers there are like, oh no, here come the worst of the worst, and assume that all these guys are, you know, best friends with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or whatever. When in fact, it was just some local, Pakistani and Afghan warlords getting paid for the most part.
Yeah, well, sure. You know, I couldn't agree more really with how it's panned out and how really, you know, how embarrassing that is that it was such a failure. But I mean, it does need to be known and it needs to go down in the historical record when hopefully this place finally is closed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the American government starts treating people either as enemy prisoners of war protected by the Geneva Conventions or as criminals to face a trial.
Yeah. Well,
When that's all gone, it will be seen. It is, unfortunately, embarrassing. This is what happens when you let a bunch of people who don't really have any detailed idea of what they're doing make up foreign policy, you know, on the hoof, really. And, you know, I mean, we've seen how much of it was driven by the arrogance of people like Dick Cheney and David Addington, that they just wanted to find ways to break the law. They thought that they were being unnaturally constrained in so many ways. And it's like, okay, guys, this is what you get when now that you get your people like John Yoo to write you those dubious and I think wrong legal advice that was written in the Office of Legal Counsel and endorsing everything that you did. Where did you take us to? You didn't take us to a place where any of this was useful. You just took us to a place that of shame and embarrassment.
Well, but see,
about how
I think
wrong
that
you were.
I think that you're making the mistake of judging their actions. As according to, say, for example, you know, what you or a regular honest person would do in that same position. I tend to believe, although I guess I don't know if there's any exact quotes indicating this from Cheney or Addington specifically, but I think it's pretty clear when you look at what they did to Binyam Mohammed in order to get his false confession that implicated Jose Padilla, what they did to Sheikh Al-Libi, who pointed his finger at Saddam Hussein and said, yeah, he taught us how to hijack planes and make chemical weapons and all these things. That and it goes on and on. You can obviously rattle them off the top of your head a lot easier than I can, but it seems to me pretty apparent that what Dick Cheney was doing was saying, beat lies out of these people. I want people pointing their finger at Saddam Hussein and saying that he's friends with Osama bin Laden. Get me that information. And so they were beating it out of people. It worked perfectly.
Well, kind of. I mean, I actually do think that they thought they were permanently faced with an existential threat unlike anything that had ever happened. And so they were actually the most credulous people you could imagine, much, much more so than the intelligence services, into believing that, you know, that everybody they rounded up was a terrorist. I mean, you know, that's what I think. I actually think they thought they were surrounded by enemies everywhere when they weren't.
Well, I mean, they were also taking advantage, pretty much. I think it was... Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's true that you have people like Lori Milroy who, you know, specialized in selling the... And Judy Miller, for that matter, who specialized in selling the lie that Saddam Hussein secretly controlled Ramzi Youssef. He wasn't the real Ramzi Youssef, and that Al-Qaeda was nothing but a front for Iraqi intelligence. I suppose it's possible that if you're Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and you really, really want to believe those lies, then you could, but... I don't know. There are a lot of people who could see right through them, too.
I honestly think that you look at the story of Binyam Muhammad, you know, was that they got it into their heads. The FBI, it was in Pakistan, first got it into their heads, you know. Binyam Muhammad told them about a spoof website that he'd seen about how to make a dirty bomb. And it all kind of started from that. They were terrified at the time that Al-Qaeda was going to get hold of nuclear weapons. They took it from that. That this guy was like, oh, whoa, we've got one. And from then on in, there was nothing that he could say, look, I had a look at a website, which is a joke website. It was written by Barbara Ehrenreich, the journalist. That was the one that he saw. She wrote about it recently. You know, it's a joke. You swirl a bucket of uranium above your head. You know, it's like, this doesn't work. You know, I know nothing about bombs. I know nothing about all these people. It didn't matter. He'd said it. They connected him to... the bad guys, and that was it. So when they were torturing him, it wasn't to make him lie. They thought they were torturing him to make him tell the truth, because they believed it.
Yeah, well...
You know, it's horrible, but I mean, you know, it's very worrying when you've got a bunch of people with so much power who seem to me to be prepared to regard, like, kind of every other brown-skinned man with a beard that they see as a terrorist.
Yeah, and they really are, you know, I mean... I know people don't like it when you talk like this, but I think it's true that mostly cops are stupid, man. And there are, and that's just in general. It doesn't mean every single one of them, but certainly at the FBI, they don't know anything about anything except trying to make themselves look good and that kind of thing. There was an interview just a year or two ago where, I think it was, CQ Politics or something, interviewed the head of counterterrorism at the FBI, the head of counterterrorism at the FBI, and said, and why don't you tell me what you know about Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda and et cetera. And the guy had nothing. He knew nothing. Hezbollah is, I don't know, lives in southern Lebanon? Nope, he doesn't know that. Al-Qaeda is made of Sunni fundamentalist types led by Ayman al-Zawahiri and whatever. Nope, never heard of them. Don't know anything about it. The head of counterterrorism.
Right. Right.
I mean, what the hell is a Lebanon anyway? I don't know where Lebanon is, he answers, you know? I mean...
Right. Yeah, well, no, that's particularly shocking. But, I mean, you know, in a general sense, I would agree with you about, you know, about the police, about the intelligence agencies, you know? And one of the problems that we have, I think, is that, to me, if somebody's arrested by the police, yeah, let's say you're not even charged, but, you know, you're just pulled in by the police for something. If you say to most people, do the police make mistakes, you know, you are right out there with Genghis Khan if you can stand up and say, no, the police never make mistakes. They never pick up somebody for the wrong reasons, you know. They never pursue cases when they shouldn't because they got the wrong person. It would be ludicrous to say that, wouldn't it?
Of course.
And yes, when it comes to issues related to terrorism, you know, we're in a position where we're actually... supposed to let the intelligence agencies, who are just, you know, a grander version of the police, if you like, do their business without being challenged. You know, it's all hush-hush. It's all top secret.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody must have any way of seeing the way that we operate because it's so important to national security. It's like, yeah, that's convenient, that, isn't it? Because it also hides all your mistakes from us because you guys are just as fallible as anybody else. And yet you're behaving as though everything that you do is correct. And you're persuading the public to think that, you know, hey, we just rounded up another guy with a beard. Must be a terrorist. Where's
right.
the evidence? Well, you know, we've got to keep quiet about that. It's insulting. And, you know, and I think that's one of the things that we need more transparency and more, not cynicism, but more skepticism about whether the intelligence agencies really know what they're doing a lot of the time, because clearly a lot of the time they haven't got a clue.
Mm. Well, and of course, everybody knows. I mean, anybody who watches Dateline NBC or whatever like that can tell you that The cops all know. They teach this in the criminal justice classes and in psychology classes, and they've done a million experiments about it, that people will confess to things they didn't do under the slightest bit of pressure. And yeah. particularly if you just put them in a small closet-sized room with a cop saying, it's true, isn't it? They will say, yes, it's true, as long as that means you will let me out of this room right now. And it doesn't matter. I don't know anything about what trial might be coming up or how this might be used against me or what might happen to me in the future. All I know is right now I want out of this room, and I will tell these cops anything I can say to get out of this room. And people do that every single day of the week.
Yeah. It's a very good point, Scott, really. It is. Yeah. But no, I mean, it is. It's stuff that happens all the time. You're right. You know, and exactly. So what are the effects of that when you don't get to be able to challenge them, you know, when you don't get to then go to a courtroom where, you know, where you've got a lawyer, you know,
who says... Right.
Defense lawyer comes to you. What's the story then? It's like, I don't know what happened, man. I just lied.
Well, now,
you know,
tell me this. So what about Bagram? What about Afghanistan and all the secret prisons? I guess Obama issued an order, said review all the secret prisons, which I guess means Diego Garcia in Thailand and Morocco or whatever. But what about Afghanistan? Because isn't it the case that once the Supreme Court told George Bush that it doesn't matter that you've got this technicality that Guantanamo is at Cuba, our jurisdiction still applies there, that he said, okay, fine. And then he started shipping everybody after that off to Afghanistan, where the theory of lawlessness still applies.
Well, I don't think he did so much. I mean, I think the separate issue with Guantanamo, which is with Afghanistan, which has just emerged now, and is really he's going to get hit a lot on this one. Is this blanket denial that prisoners in Bagram have any rights? Now, I understand what this is based on. You know, this is a prison in a war zone. I have an issue as to why it should be an American war zone so long after the U.S. invasion and the establishment of an Afghan government, but that's another matter. Technically, it is a war zone, so therefore, if prisoners are going to be held there who are caught as part of a conflict in Afghanistan, then what concerns me is that they are genuinely treated according to the Geneva Convention. Now, that's going to require some really proper instruction in the military to say, do you remember the days before Donald Rumsfeld came in and said, do what the hell you want, beat the crap out of these people, and all that happened. Do you remember when we used to abide by the Geneva Conventions? Because that's what we're going back to. You're going to treat these people with respect, okay? If you go back to that, then okay, I don't have a problem with how people are being held within Afghanistan. But the problem is that there are 30 prisoners. This seems to be the estimate, because nobody knows. Nobody's been able to get in the place. There are about 30 prisoners who were captured all over the place in other countries, from other countries, who are essentially the same as a lot of the prisoners in Guantanamo. So, you know, they're caught completely outside a battlefield. They're regarded as, you know, dangerous people who've been rendered. They've been through secret prisons, all kinds of stuff. And yet the prisoners turned around and said, we're not giving any rights to these people. Now, that's really not acceptable at all, because I really do think these people are in exactly the same position as the people in Guantanamo.
Right. Well, I mean, this is what happened to Binyam Mohammed. He was arrested, I think you said, in Pakistan. He was taken to Morocco to be mutilated and tortured, and then he was sent to Afghanistan, where he was kept in the dark prison, they call it. And I guess, is that the same thing as the salt pit torture dungeon? Are those different?
There were two separate ones, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, there you go. So who knows what all prisons they have there. And then he was sent to Guantanamo. So there's one example right there. I guess you say there are about 30 of them that we know of. Is that right? Of people who hadn't necessarily ever been to Afghanistan, who were sent there simply for the lawlessness.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and, you know, and the cases of those men need to be addressed. I mean, you know, You can't defend, you know, these guys have been there 6 or 7 years, some of them. You can't defend that on the basis that this is a Geneva Convention's wartime prison, because it clearly isn't. You know, if you kidnapped a guy in Thailand and took him to Bagram and held him for 7 years without letting anybody see him, where's the battlefield?
All right, everybody, that's Andy Worthington, defender of the Magna Carta. You can find his blog at andyworthington.co.uk. He writes for us at antiwar.com, also for Counterpunch, the Future Freedom Foundation. Where else can people find your work?
They can find it sometimes on the Huffington Post.
Mm-hmm.
Caged Prisoners here in the UK. That's a good site for people to go and have a look at.
Great. And the book is The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. And the new movie coming out will be called Outside the Law, or what was the other one?
I think we're going to go for Outside the Law. Scott.
Outside the Law.
You convinced me.
Yeah, I convinced him. You like that, everybody? All right. Okay. Hey, thanks very much for your time, Andy. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott.